It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we are debating the very... I'm not... I saw you do that out of the corner of my eye and thought, he's not going to actually do that.
Right, that's the last Christmas
blooper.
Christmas joke.
You should have been recording it, Andy. Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we are debating the very future of the beautiful game as a court rules that UEFA cannot block the creation of new competitions. So, is the European Super League back on the agenda? We'll also be discussing Nottingham Forest, Kieran Trippier, Aston Villa and looking ahead to what we'd like to see in 2024. And joining me, Tom Clark, today we have the chief correspondent for The Times and Sunday Times, Martin Samuel, the football correspondent for the Sunday Times, Jonathan Northcroft, and a former footballer whose last match on Boxing Day was a thriller in 2014, in which his Northampton team had a certain Ivan Toney sent off and lost 3-2 to Bury. Gregor Robertson will be hoping for a more enjoyable Christmas this year. Well, chaps, let's get straight into it with the news that is breaking on this Thursday morning as we were preparing for this podcast. And as Tom Allnutt reports on the Times website now, UEFA's hopes of killing off the European Super League project were dealt a massive blow after a court ruling said the governing body had no legal right to block the creation of new competitions. UEFA threatened to impose sanctions on any clubs and players that joined the European Super League after it was launched in April 2021. But the European Court of Justice has said that FIFA and UEFA's rules requiring their approval for new football competitions are contrary to EU law. The ruling is binding and not subject to appeal. Now, responding to the verdict on Twitter, chief executive of the A22, is one of the backers of the Super League, Bernd Reichart, wrote that the European Super League have won the right to exist. He added that UEFA's monopoly is over, football is free, clubs are now free from the threat of sanctions and free to determine their own future. I'm just going to add one more bit from the actual statement itself, which I think is important. In the statement, they say that there is no framework for FIFA and UEFA rules ensuring that they are transparent, objective, non-discriminatory and proportionate. They say that the previous sanctions prohibiting clubs and players from playing in any new competitions were unlawful. However, they also add that that does not mean that a competition such as the Super League project must necessarily be approved. So then, is the game gone, Martin? Is it all up?
The thing is, just because the competition exists doesn't mean you have to compete in it. So it's still down to the individual clubs to decide whether or not a closed shop European Super League is something that they would entertain or their fans would be interested in them joining. As far as who you want to win on this, I'm sort of with... It's the W.C. Fields argument that in the event of war, the leaders of the respective warring nations should be made to fight it out with socks full of manure. And I would very much be in favour of that. Or indeed the single stick duel as depicted by Goya in the art galleries of Madrid, in which two people are buried up to their knees in mud, given a club each, and just left to beat each other to death with it. And that, you know, Merry Christmas, everybody. Either image, you know, depending on how crude or intellectual you're feeling this morning. It's just thoroughly depressing because all it is about is rich football clubs trying to get richer. All it is about is football trying to become less competitive than it was before. It's everything that really I can't stand. And to even feel as if you've got a dog in this fight somehow feels wrong because on both sides are these systems that just continue making the rich clubs rich. You've only got to see what's going to happen to the Club World Cup, where they're talking about all of the entrants getting £50 million potentially each. And no one gives a thought to what £50 million does to the domestic league in New Zealand if you give £50 million to Auckland City in a league that small. That's the end of the league. That just kills the domestic league in that country. And no one gives any thought to this. All they want is money, 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 money. So it's a legal ruling. It's a depressing ruling. But the whole thing is sort of depressing, really.
Mm. Johnny, your reaction to, well, both the news but also Martin's analysis?
Yeah, Martin's analysis is hard to beat, actually. But I can't give you sticks or... Bernd Reinhardt, is that the guy
Reichardt,
from the
80s? Yeah.
I mean, just reading that fascinates me because I do wonder, I mean, is this guy, has he got offices that have suddenly cranked into action this morning or is he just sitting in his bedroom because he's the chief exec of something that doesn't exist yet?
Yeah.
But look, I think what Martin correctly encapsulates is that this can't exist unless people want it to exist, essentially. So in some ways, this ruling isn't a great surprise. There's always been a contradiction between the UEFA's position as the lawmaker, but then also the people who run the competition. And I've heard from Premier League clubs for a long time, and this isn't in the context of the Super League, just as a general point that this is wrong. How can you make the laws, but then also, you know, profit from the competition that the laws apply to? So I think that's what the judgment may be challenging. What it does mean is that the A22 clubs will try and come back with something. I think we always expected that all along. It's important to remember that Super League didn't fail because UEFA ruled against it. Super League failed because the public ruled against it and the Premier League clubs pulled out. And Bayern Munich and PSG probably preempted more cleverly than the Premier League clubs which way the wind was blowing and didn't join in the first place. And then it slowly died a death. But it wasn't UEFA that blocked it in the first place. So I've always been sceptical about the fact that UEFA can stop it anyway. I don't think they decide on this. As I say, I think it's a public, it's the fans who decide, and that therefore that'll depend, you know, the clubs will take notice of that. What I'd expect is the Super League to try and come back, but this time with meritocracy thrown in, meritocracy of a sort, because the big mistake Super League made was trying to launch with a closed shop, and that's the thing that everyone reacted against. If they'd tried to launch but with some form of meritocracy, I think there'd have been a slightly different reaction. I think we know the self-interest of fans and the thought that their club could get immeasurably richer as long as it was, I think meritocracy is something everyone upholds as valuable, but a kind of compromise, which is what the Champions League has always been and the expanded Champions League is going to be, may have worked. And it's interesting looking at UEFA's statement this morning where they basically say, we expected this ruling. It doesn't mean that we're not still in charge. But it was the last paragraph I found fascinating, which it talks about how UEFA want to uphold the irreplaceable model of football. But their irreplaceable model is solidarity. In the statement, it's not meritocracy. They've just mentioned solidarity, which means obviously filtering the money downwards. But there's nothing in the statement about meritocracy, because as we know, as we've talked about before, they're quite keen to introduce some kind of what do they call it again, Mark? It's not legacy. It's
legacy, historical places, legacy places.
They quite like that.
You know, that was the original proposal. Was install the places upon, and legacy places.
I think that's been rolled back upon.
It's been rolled back, but UEFA like it as a concept.
Because everyone goes nuts about it. Every time it happens, it means you get rewarded for something that that happened 20, 30 years ago. And what people like about football, I think, is you get rewarded for what happened last season. Mm. And, you know, you're only as good as your last game. You're only as good as the last season. Yeah. You're not good because something happened 30 years ago that gave you six European Cups or whatever.
I think this comes down... The bottom line in all of this, and always has been, is do the Premier League clubs join it or not?
Mm.
It can't fly without the Premier League clubs. The Premier League clubs have got the most to lose as well, because they're already in the best competition in the world, which is killing all the other competitions. I've never seen, just from the core business terms, I've never really seen why they would go and try and enrich some of their European rivals while diluting the competition that they're already in that's so good. Because they're not as bright as they think. Because they think more short-term, don't they?
Yeah, they're not as bright as they think. They think they're smart, but they're not smart.
Martin, do you agree with Johnny's point that a kind of a Super League 2 with a slightly kind of amended approach might actually fly with fans as well as with clubs?
I think it depends how big the meritocratic part of it is. Do you not, John, that if it's only a lip service to it, I'm not sure people will buy into it. You know, I think it's got to be something that makes the Leicester dream possible, that makes the Aston Villa dream that is unfolding at the moment, shall we say, possible, that makes it possible that Newcastle can come in from outside. If you are putting obstacles in the way of that, if, for instance, unless you've got enough ranking points, coefficient points, legacy points, however clearly you want to define them, if Aston Villa could come second, say, and not end up in the main competition next season, if they could just be then, it's for champions and these select clubs only, then I don't think that will fly. I really don't think that will fly with the fans. I think they want to... I think people want the dream that your team... You know, in the old days, it was that your team win the league and qualify for the European Cup. Now it is that your team come in the top four. So unless a top four place continues to be rewarded with a place in the main competition, I think there would be a pushback against it.
Yeah, I mean,
maybe I'm over.
No, I think you're right, Matt. But I think there's ways that they might try and appease that or preempt that pushback. And Tom Alnutt in his backgrounder yesterday was talking about an idea which involves 80 teams in a Super League divisions of. Four divisions of 20 or something like that, which of course then allows you to the Aston Villas can join, everyone can join, but one suspects that the top league of that competition would have the familiar names in it. But I just think there's a feeling that everything's in play. You know, we've got a new Champions League coming on board, which I don't think anyone likes the look of, really.
You don't understand it.
You don't understand it, and it already goes against our instincts for what a competition should be.
You should play home and away.
Straight away,
European competition has always been about home and away, and then suddenly, we play Bayern Munich away, but we don't play them at home, and we play PSG at home, but we never play them away. It's not what we've been brought up on. And we've been, it's not like we've been brought up on this for 2 minutes. We've been brought up on this for 70 odd years now.
So I think there's a weak Champions League coming in, and the Club World Cup's making its pitch to become a big competition. And, the time is ripe for the Super League clubs to go again, because, as I say, everything seems to be up in the air at the moment, and a new league order's ready to be established.
I think we're talking about two different things. I think we're talking about reform of European competition, which is in play, and the Super League, which I think is dead in the water, because it's literally going to be enshrined in law soon in the UK that the independent regular has to approve. Independent regular has to approve a club entering like any other new competition, and there's obviously been new rules brought in by the Premier League too. So Premier League clubs, as things stand, cannot join whatever this
might
thing
be,
is, yeah. might be, yeah. J- the idea of German clubs doing it is fanciful too, because of the sort of structure and social sort of political status of clubs in Germany as well. So that's two big, very big leaks, right? So,
yeah. And what do you make to Johnny's
clubs challenge this, though?
I was just about to say, couldn't it be challenged in law the way that this was challenged in law?
Yeah, potentially. I want to talk about the point Johnny made about the kind of power to the people type angle, which were you very much pushed when this story first broke the last time, Gregor, in terms of the power of the fans, and as was proved with the reaction and things, fans at Stamford Bridge and Anfield and around the country. Do you think that ultimately that sense is still there? That's still the overriding sense of emotion within this country to this feeling, that knee-jerk reaction of kind of what Martin said, of a unpleasant taste in the mouth, if you like, that whenever this story comes up, fans go, nah, not for us.
Absolutely. I don't think anything's changed in that regard. It would take, you know, a lot of PR work and spin to change that. And ultimately, the thing that we come back to is what Martin started with, is how sort of unpalatable it is to see UEFA and FIFA going at it like rats in a sack to control, you know, not only European but world football and all the revenue that generates. And so the idea of also clubs almost sort of taking that rest and control of that for themselves, and owners of clubs who are all, you know, now rich, you know, capitalist American investors, countries, in fact, the idea of that is arguably more unpalatable. So selling this in any way to fans in most countries in Europe, I think, is a huge, huge stumbling block. And currently, I can't see how it's overcome, really.
It was a hippie slogan in the 60s, about, I think, which went, suppose they gave a war and nobody came. And that's where we are now. That's the strongest pushback against it. Suppose they put on a tournament and nobody came. Nobody turned. Everyone just went, no, I'm not doing that. The complication you've got, fans have got, is to what extent their club has been wrested from their control by the global marketplace. Because they could argue, well, does it matter if Old Trafford's full or not full if we suddenly move this game to New York, or if we suddenly move this game to Jeddah, or whatever. You know, this is the thing that once it's the global game, the person paying their money to go into their local football club and sit in their seat and or stand behind the goal or whatever they're doing and watch their match is becoming increasingly marginalised. You know, attendance figures. You can't get an attendance figure anymore, not a real attendance figure, because everyone goes on season tickets and this. So you're looking at a half-empty stadium and they're saying there's 50,000 people there, and you're looking at, oh, there's no one there. Where are they? So the person going to the match, you've only got to see the whole VAR business and how increasingly insignificant these people are being made to feel. And that is my only worry. I totally take Gregor's point, and it is the best pushback possible is if the fans reject it. That's the best pushback possible. At the same time, you do wonder whether that conversation has already been had at various football clubs and at A22 or whatever they're called. Yeah, 22, isn't that down to... Is that Bexley or something?
Oh, no, we're not getting into motor journeys again, please.
But anyway, at A22 or whatever, do you not think they've already had that conversation and they've decided that as long as the money's right, then, you know, we can afford to go the fans for two or three seasons, maybe, until they come round to our way of thinking. I don't know. It's as
so
John
it gets
said,
a bit dystopian, that doesn't it? Because when you know, even when you talk about, like, I was thinking, reading the story in the tube on the way in, and thinking, you know, let anyone who wants to do this go off and do it.
Yeah,
because the Premier League is in a really strong position.
It is.
But then you start thinking, and because also fundamentally, this is always about, it's about greed, it's about growth, eternal lust for growth.
Yeah, totally.
And football doesn't need any more growth. It's big enough. There's enough money in the game. There's too much money in the game. Yeah. So when you come to that standpoint, you think, go on, do what you want, guys. But then you start to think, right, then maybe when they do that and, you know, everyone just is supplanted to Saudi Arabia or somewhere, and then all the best players start to go over there, and it starts to get a bit dystopian.
Yeah.
And then maybe you think, oh, the Premier League is no longer the strongest force. So, you know, we do have to be on guard here. But, I mean, that's a long way off. And as I say, I was sort of getting into going down a wormhole of thinking there. But,
but it's
possible. It's that's probably what the vision is for a lot of the people involved in this. To you know, whatever they can do to bring in the most revenue. Ultimately what they want to do.
And I just come, if it is about greed, surely the logical thing for greedy Premier League clubs is to stick with the Premier League and just let everyone else wither, and then invite Real Madrid and Barcelona in if you want to. Do you know what I mean? I've never seen the rationale for propping up the very clubs that you're competing with for players, for example. Well,
but could a Super League, compete with the Premier League eventually?
Of course it could.
If the Premier League clubs are in it.
If there's the backing of, say, Saudi Arabia, and as we've already seen players start to go somewhere because there's more money on offer, you know, it's possible. It's possible that the two are there and might even compete against each other.
And by the way, the backing of Saudi Arabia, Gregor, is, you know, far from an outlandish idea, because the other thing with this is where we're looking at UEFA and FIFA on one side and the Super League on the other. FIFA are only on that side because they now feel their own position being threatened. At the start of the Super League, when it was first vaunted, the suggestion was that Infantino not only knew about it, but gave it the thumbs up, because it would have neutered UEFA, which is, without a shadow of a doubt, one of FIFA's aims. Probably neutered the power of the Premier League as well. And FIFA are in favour of both of those things.
And more money.
And more money. And that almost as if the Super League and FIFA and that whole umbrella. Also, there's so many different strands of this. I will point out, it's called the Super League. It's not called the European Super League. People refer to it sometimes as the European Super League, but it was never called that. And I thought that was very interesting, because right from the very start, they have left that door open, that what we've got in the end is Rollerball, if you've ever seen the film Rollerball, where they're playing Tokyo one minute and Madrid the next and everything like that. There is the door open for further down the line, if Inter Miami are doing well enough that they could join, and then this one could join from here and that one could join from there. And the Super League is the Super League, and it's a global Super League, not just a European Super League. It depends where they think the audience is. You know, Real Madrid don't think enough people are interested in football. I don't know how many people they think would be enough, but, you know, but they don't think enough people are interested in football. And so the idea of globalising it even more.
Yeah. Well, their argument is that this is the young generation, isn't it? That's the Real Madrid market research people under the age of 25
just want names.
And they're not that bothered about traditional competitions. I don't know.
Yeah, look, who knows? I mean, we're all old enough, shot it. But,
excuse me, thank you very much. Yeah. Absolutely. We'll have none of that, absolutely not. Yeah. Well, we don't need to know what I think, because there'll be plenty more time to debate this as the season continues, I'm sure. Greedy suits versus the football fans. Maybe it's time that football had its Christmas Carol moment and a bit of a reckoning with itself. Let's talk about some actual football, shall we? And we're going to talk about some EFL Cup reaction. Liverpool, Fulham, Middlesbrough and Chelsea all into the semi-finals. But I wanted to talk about West Ham. Martin, the life of a columnist can be a tricky one. And you certainly, give us our money's worth with all your wonderful words throughout the week. But it doesn't always go to plan.
Scowling as he says that.
Doesn't always go to plan, does it? On Monday you said that West Ham would be wrong to get rid of David Moyes.
I wrote 1,000 words on David Moyes very positively about West Ham and the whole debate.
He's really got it. He's starting to really understand what it is to be a West Ham manager. And then he went into a match at Anfield, rested Lucas Paquetá and a number of others, and got thrashed 5-1. How do you feel about it?
Yeah, well, no, it's very rare when you write a column that you read such an eloquent and comprehensive rebuttal of everything you've written within about 2.5 days, but 1.5 days, really. But that team sheet did it last night, certainly for me. Look, I'm really sorry. I can't understand that. I cannot understand that. That is everything. When you write a piece like that in favour of David Moyes, and I know Johnny is very close to John's heart, and he will come in, I realise. But when you write something like that in favour, you know, you'll get people, West Ham fans, and everyone saying, he's too negative, he's this, he hasn't got the ambition, he doesn't get it, he doesn't this. Well, no, it's not like that. And then you see the team, you think, oh, Dave, give me a break, would you, mate? Just give me just a week, basically, when people can't just go, see, told you so. No, I was extraordinarily puzzled. On Tuesday night, three teams got into the semi-final of the Carabao Cup. Fulham, Middlesbrough, and the worst Chelsea team in 25 years. If ever there was a moment when you could look at that as West Ham manager and go, we're three games away from a trophy here. You know,
all we've got to do is beat Liverpool. We're
Liverpool away, but you know Liverpool are going to rest players because they have got Arsenal and they're trying to win the league on Sunday. You know they're going to rest players. West Ham are playing Manchester United at 12:30. I completely get that. If West Ham had put their first team out last night, if they'd have won or even come very close and then got beat by Manchester United on Saturday, I think almost all reasonable fans would have understood that they were going for it. They were going for the Carabao Cup. But I think I've always thought that what the half-strength team does is two things. One of them is, you've got a half-strength team. The second is the first team players that are in there, you've sort of shown them what your priority is, which is Manchester United on Saturday. So their priority suddenly becomes, make sure I'm about for Manchester United on Saturday. So you get that sort of limp, weak performance, which is what West Ham turned in last night. And I was really disappointed because I did think it would be different. I did think that, you know, it's a season when West Ham aren't going to go down. You've got a chance there. You've really got a chance there. West Ham won a trophy last year, a European trophy, absolutely sensational. They've never won the League Cup. They haven't won a domestic trophy since 1980. This was a good chance.
Johnny, case for the defence? Is there any?
It might not necessarily be a case for defence, actually.
There's not a great case for defence, to be honest. And actually, I think Martin, your column was pretty accurate about David, and it still is, because I think what you explained in it was that what you've got is a very competent and pragmatic and successful in those terms manager. And you've got a fan base who crave a bit of romance and fun. Yeah. And those two worlds are sometimes going to collide. And I felt they did last night. I can entirely understand the rational, pragmatic football manager argument for resting. And he only rested three players, really. Zouma.
But they were really crucial.
But they were crucial. And Paquetá's the one, yeah, above all
He's
else,
above that, all else. That Absolutely.
Fans want to see, and had such a great game at the weekend. But this is a club that's been competing every Thursday night for two seasons now, and competing very successfully. And it doesn't have the biggest squad. And there's a tough programme and a tough Saturday game coming up. So there are all of those practical considerations. And David Moyes will always do the rational, practical thing. He's not a gambler. He's not a romantic, caution to the wind type of person. We know that. And last night, he played to type, and I can imagine how that must have felt as a West Ham fan.
8,000 up there. There's the 8,000 up there as well, where you think, tell us before we buy the ticket. Say we're not going to, we're not bothering with this. So why, I wouldn't if I was you either.
It's one of those things too that it's like, it's been cited as, part of the excellent start to the season they've had. we're 8th in the league. We've qualified for the third consecutive season for European football after Christmas. We're in the quarter-finals of the Carabao Cup against Liverpool. Yeah. and then you play that team. Like, it was, yeah, you understand all the reasoning, but Martin and I were talking about it before. The fact that this year they are in such a strong league position, they're not fighting a relegation battle, then that's understandable then, because, like, ultimately, you might not like it, but ultimately, that, you know, Premier League, securing Premier League status is always the number one priority. Mm. But that's not an issue this year. Mm. And, yeah, I completely agree that, if, you know, this was a chance to win a trophy.
Not much defence for David Moyes then, but speaking of defence and defenders, Kieran Trippier, I wanted to talk about him. It's been a remarkable run of performances, really, for Newcastle's star player in many ways since their kind of upturn in fortunes. Gregor, is there any explanation for this? I mean, is this just a dip in form?
Someone who's had a lot of stinkers. Explain.
I didn't say that. Because this is a bit, it feels a bit more than a dip in form. You know, the errors are quite glaring and also look like a player who, I don't know, is tired, is a bit distracted. I'm not quite sure. But it's hurting Newcastle in a big way, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a remarkable kind of change in fortunes, because he was Newcastle's best player for the first, I don't know, 14 games of the season or something. And now he just can't seem to do anything right. And it's like, sometimes it's kind of just a cumulative effect. I think once you make some mistakes, your confidence takes a blow. You're just slightly inhibited. You're not playing quite the same sort of with the same freedom, which, you know, is a big part of his game. And sometimes just things don't go right for you. It's hard to say. I think even the best players, like even someone who's as resolute and mentally sort of strong as you would think that Kieran Trippie is, confidence is an issue. Like if he takes a knock and you get into a rut, then sometimes it's very difficult to get out of.
With a big run of games coming up at this kind of time of year, when if you are struggling, it, you know, at any level, I know you always make jokes, well, I'm not Kieran Trippier, I know that, but do you want to keep playing to get a good performance under your belt? You don't actually want to hide, do you? You don't want to not play.
No, absolutely. That makes it worse. You've got to put yourself back in the kind of firing line. We had this discussion about Harry Maguire, you know, not so long ago, saying that, you know, he's really, I think I said he's not, I'm not sure he is really someone who's mentally strong, but what he is someone who is willing to always put himself in a difficult situation. And that's ultimately what you have to do. You've got to be willing to put yourself back in the sort of line of fire, as it were, and just work your way through it and get back out the other side. And that's ultimately, these moments come along in football all the time, even for the best players.
Martin, Kieran Trippier?
Who I think is, on his game, possibly the best right back in the country. I mean, Kyle Walker, notwithstanding, Kyle Walker has other qualities as well. But I think Kieran Trippier's got one quality, certainly, that I think he's better than anyone else. I think he's the best first time crosser of the ball in the country. And I think doing that for England when he was in the England team regularly, that really did change the way England play, in the way that Beckham changed the way. Beckham used to hit his crosses exceptionally early from high up the field. He didn't really have the pace to get to the byline all the time. So Beckham's great genius was that he hit first-time crosses, but he hit them from deep, and that took everyone by surprise, and people weren't set up, and the striker knew to look for it. Kieran Trippier doesn't take a touch when he puts the ball in a lot of the time. It's first time hit and very, very accurate and really in dangerous positions. I love Kieran Trippier. He's playing like a drain at the moment. I mean, the last three or four games. I said earlier, I don't think he's quite been the same since that confrontation with the fans after they got beat at Bournemouth. I don't know if that's a thing. You know, that's absolute amateur psychiatry. But he hasn't looked quite the same since then. I think in the week, I just think the mistake that he made, he wasn't expecting Mudryk to be where he was. Usually, you know, that sort of header might have actually, he might have been challenged more, and that header just gets it into a dead space and someone else clears it, and instead Mudryk is short of that space, basically, so just runs straight onto it.
It's uncertainty. He's actually someone who so often you see chesting the ball back to his goalkeeper or doing something, you think, oh, crikey, that was calm, that was cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he just sees that, that sort of element of uncertainty in his mind. Mm. He just didn't he didn't commit to doing one thing or t'other.
No.
And that was the result.
I just think we've been sort of talking about it, really, about how everyone's getting rinsed by this greed, this desire for more games, more money, and footballers are human beings, and I think it's a perfect storm with Kieran Trippier. That was his 91st game since the start of last season. You know, he's played a lot. He's 33. He's playing in the most dynamic position in football, fullback. You know, he's trying to do all that.
He's for a team that is absolutely uber dynamic.
Yeah, and he's a captain, as we saw at Bournemouth.
I got one of those last night. Cost me a fortune.
Did you?
Anyway, carry on.
The more expensive ones. I was ignoring them.
Sorry, Kevin.
No, but I mean, when he goes on the pitch, he takes on more than just his own game. He takes on the responsibility of the armband and his club. And Eddie House talked a lot about how much he does culturally at Newcastle. And so there's a lot on his shoulders. And I looked it up before we came on. He's got three young kids. He's got an 18-month-old baby at home. Well, yeah, exactly. These people, they're human beings, and it just looks like he's mentally tired. As Gregor said, you could see the uncertainty. You could see his face. He just looked drained, didn't he? And he looked, oh no. And the penalty was very un-Trippier like because.
I was kind of watching it.
He just wanted to get it. It was horrendous, wasn't it? He just wanted to get it over with.
Yeah.
And almost like get out of the stadium.
Well, you talk about him being tired. It's not going to get any easier, I imagine, for Kieran Trippier. He's got matches against Luton on the 23rd of December and a tough game against Nottingham Forest, potentially on Boxing Day. See if they're rejuvenated by a new manager, which we'll be discussing in the next part of the show. We've only got one more show this year after today, and that'll be on Wednesday, the 27th of December. In it, we'll be talking about the latest action, but also having a bit of a review of the year, discussing our favourite moments, matches, players and goals. So if you've got a nomination or contender, please get in touch with me, tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. Stick with us. As I say, next we'll be talking about Nottingham Forest, but also what we'd like to see in 2024.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Hello and welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Tom Clark and today I'm joined by Johnny Northcroft, Martin Samuel and Gregor Robertson. And Gregor, we're going to go to Nottingham Forest, your former club. It's finally happened. Steve Cooper is out of a job. We've been talking about it for a long, long time. He has left the club, sacked and replaced by Nuno Espirito Santo. What do you make of it? Sad times. Lots of Nottingham Forest fans. Quite striking, really, wasn't it? All the clips of fans outside the ground. It was big death.
Big death in the family, wasn't it? Well, you've got to remember how kind of 23 years for a club of Nottingham Forest size outside the top flight was painful. You know, I was part of that. and so the man who got them back, and in remarkable fashion too, obviously, what he inherited, I think, you know, bottom of the table after seven games or something, to take them up through the playoffs, it was a huge moment, cathartic moment for them. So. And then there's the sort of realization that, you know, as I said the other week, that there's just never been any sort of feeling that there's any synergy between the club under this ownership, Evangelos Marinakis, and Steve Cooper as a person. You know, he's kind of very calm and measured, and you know, as I said the other day, like a process-driven coach and someone who the players love. That's the one thing I think will be interesting now, because despite there's been some, you know, there've been the odd rumbling recently about, you know, discontent. I think a couple of players were banished for Joe Worrall and McKenna for different reasons. And obviously there's another influx of players, and you know, but there, he's always managed to generate real goodwill and you know, a buy-in from the players. So considering what they've all been through, even if some of them haven't been there that long, but considering that they've all been through that together in the Premier League, it'd be interesting for any man to come in and sort of and engage them.
Martin, on that idea that Greg is there, that, you know, as much as fans can be very upset because of what he did and the achievements he made, they have also been struggling recently for form and, you know, had some bad results. Could this be a case of one of those where it can be sad that he's leaving, but it is also right that he was sacked?
Well, I never like to, you know, say, oh, he'd be sacked this manager or sacked this manager. I very, very rarely, you know, I'll be critical of managers, but I very rarely call for anyone to be sacked, because you don't know everything that's going on. You don't know what restrictions or whatever. All I would say with Nottingham Forest is, as much as Steve Cooper got them up and did fabulously well, the guy who owns the club, you know, has also got them up and done well and has spent his money. And
I disagree with that.
You disagree with that?
I think he lucked out with Steve Cooper.
Do you really?
Absolutely. Okay, I think they were like hurling pieces of a puzzle at the board and they all fit because Steve Cooper came in. That was like, they continue to hurl pieces at the board. I fundamentally, you could throw enough money at something, but I would be amazed if Forrester, the success that he wants them to be, and, you know, he has the money to make them a success, I'm amazed with the strategy they have that that'll ever happen.
No, I can quite see that. All I'm saying is, the man has spent his money.
Yeah.
And if you spend that much money, and if you own the football club, then you make the big judgment calls. And then you're judged or otherwise on whether the judgment call is right. So Steve Cooper got them up, but the money helped get them up as well. The money has helped keep them there as well. So I don't feel super strongly that this is a total injustice. I think Steve Cooper's a very good manager. I think he'll get another job and I think he'll do very well in that job.
Johnny, your reaction to both those points, because I want to ask you about the successor, Nuno, but just your reaction first to the points the guys were making.
Yeah, I think I'd be more on Gregor's side on this in terms of how much of it was down to Maranakis and how much was down to Steve
Cooper. I'm just
Cooper.
Saying that he spends his money, that's all.
I like
owners that spend their money and invest in their football club, that's all.
I get that. And yes, he was helped by some of the players signed did turn out to be pretty good. Morgan Gibbs-White, you know, Forrest couldn't have bought that type of player at that level before Maranakis' money. But the thing for me was having somehow got them up, and then some. I think last season was an incredible achievement by Steve Cooper to keep Forest in the league with the start they had because of the influx of 33 players and what that does culturally to a place. It just rips everything up, and he somehow managed to make sense of it and keep them up and keep the place as happy as it was. And I think he earned the right to manage this season as more to how his vision, I guess, and instead of which he gets another 13 players foisted on him and it's made it impossible from the start. And Forest aren't a bad team. They're not far away. They've never been far away. It's not like you can see the players are still responding to him, and I don't think their chances of staying up have been enhanced by getting rid of him.
Interesting to think then, talking about big squads and lots of players, because I want to read an excerpt from an interview that you did, Johnny, with Nuno Espirito Santo when he was at Wolves back in February 2020 for the Sunday Times. Absolutely fascinating interview and a typically eloquent intro from you, but I'm going to skip further down to a paragraph that reads, "And what a job he's doing. Last 16 of the Europa League, contending for the Premier League top four, last season 7th and FA Cup semi-finalist. His Wolves are so reliably good, people forget they finished 15th in the Championship before he arrived. Questions about his next opponent, Jose Mourinho, bore him, but Nuno's belief beliefs, small squads, close player relationships, coaching the fine details were undoubtedly influenced by being number two keeper for Mourinho's all-conquering Porto. And this is interesting, isn't it, about his successor, because, and he himself spoke about it in his press conference at Forest yesterday, Tottenham slightly scarred me, etc., etc. You know, I'm going to be the Wolves version of Nuno. That's what I'm going to bring to Nottingham Forest. Give us your kind of reaction to that, having done that interview, and tell us a bit more about the man when you met him.
Well, it's all about fitting coaches to the right job, and clearly Tottenham was a disastrous fit for a person like Nuno. And when I did that interview, which was, I think, February 2020, that was the peak. That was peak Nuno, and you know, it's easy to forget. They were competing for the top four at that point. They were competing for the Europa League, and he'd brought them up from the Championship. But I found fascinating.
And then it went into lockdown.
Yeah. And who knows? They were in such a great moment, weren't they?
If you carry on that rhythm.
Yeah. But he, as he touched on in that interview, he was quite unlike, I think, most football managers, if not any football manager I've met. Very introverted, probably very, very deep, very guarded. I actually did the interview with another two journalists, and it took us, you know, that bit at the start of an interview when you're trying to warm up the subject and find out what's going to get this person engaged and interested. Where can we go with this? And usually it takes a few questions, but with him it took 20 minutes. And there was a point in the process we thought this isn't going to work. He didn't want to talk, and then he came alive when we started talking to him about his background and coming from a small African island, Principe, if that's how you pronounce it, and his childhood on the beach and blah blah blah. And that led to a discussion about simplicity and what this guy likes. He's kind of monkish in his outlook, is quietness, order, simplicity. In football, he likes a really small squad. He said clubs make mistakes by having 25-man squads. They should have 18-man squads. He explained the rationale behind that. He said, because when you've got a 25-man squad, that means that half of them aren't playing every week, and that means that culturally it's difficult to keep those guys on board. Jeez. Training becomes unwieldy because you end up with half the players need to do recovery work because they've played at the previous game, and half of them actually need work in their legs because they haven't played. And if you have 18 and they're all playing all the time, then you know from a sports science point of view it works. He talked about disciplining a squad, and that was a fascinating take that he had on that, because he said, yeah, I don't believe in fining players. What does a fine mean to a Premier League footballer? He said, if a player's late in my club, I will make everybody wait on the training ground. You know, our weight practice will start when that late person gets there. So the player rushes in and sees everyone's waiting for him, and everyone's getting called and everyone's annoyed, and that polices them much better. Mm. Now, all of that makes perfect sense when you've got an 18-man squad, but how on earth does that fit Nottingham Forest?
You might just as well have said, you know, what I really don't like is teams that play in red. Yeah, for Nottingham. You know, that's what I could never really manage. Any team that plays in red from Nottingham. You know, I mean,
Like Rivers near football.
Yeah, band. I don't know. Yeah, yeah.
It's bad
luck. And if there's a cricket team anywhere in the vicinity, forget it. Yeah, I mean,
The thing about Forest is that there is no manager that marries with their outlook.
No, there's no manager that turns around and says, what I want is 40 players.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, to constantly have his overbearing ownership kind of like saying, you should have made that sub, you should have, you know, assigned him, why are you not playing him? You know, why did you want to sign him?
But
he's rubbish.
Steve Cooper getting a lot of that?
Yeah, yeah, always. Yeah, always. There were little things that you've read in, you know, Charlotte's piece and stuff about like, Cooper was this big figure, and when he reached 100 games, there was not a mention about it from the club, because they didn't think he was doing a good job. He constantly had that, and if he signed a player, I think it was suggested he wanted to sign Wood and Shelvey, and they've not worked. So he was, you know, he would go around saying, the club would be kind of, I think at one point he said he's a dead man walking in a boardroom, like. There was no, there's no hiding this fact. Mm. So, and if you look at his other club, you think he's on the fifth manager in the past 16 months or something like that, Olympiacos. And it's not just the manager either. Like, so there's this churn of players, there's a churn of staff. They wanted to sign a set piece coach. This was from the club, and they wanted to employ Giovanni Vio, who's been at Spurs and well known. He said, "I don't want him." So they've signed someone else. And but this is not, you know, there's no like. No. It was a constant. They were at loggerheads. Mm. So I come back to it. Forrest will keep throwing, unless they change, we'll just keep throwing pieces at the puzzle and hope they fit.
And Greg, I mean, what would style of play? I'd be interested to get your take on that, because it seemed to me that Cooper was given the City ground the kind of football they enjoyed. One of Nuno's issues at Spurs clearly is a very methodical, reactive coach, perhaps counter-attacking coach. You know,
it was good to watch the Wolves, though.
They were good to watch at their peak, weren't they?
Yeah. I mean, they were kind of really, really sort of searing counter-attacking team.
Yeah.
Really.
That's what he wants.
Obdurate, disciplined sort of defensive structure who could spring forward. And Kenny Cooper did that. He sort of moved that way to, and that's when they sort of start to look like they might survive last season. I think he wanted to evolve that, but you know, he kept getting thrown more pieces at the puzzle. So I don't really have a worry about the football, actually. I think the Spurs thing was a bad fit. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying this is a good fit, but having a sort of a disciplined structure and being exciting when they win the ball back and, you know, in transitions, as they call it these days, that's the Forest fans will be up for that.
It'll be interesting to see how Nuno Espirito Santo gets on. Nottingham Forest at home on Saturday against Bournemouth, and then away at Newcastle, as I mentioned earlier. See if they can get some victories to turn their season around. One team who are definitely excited about the Christmas period is Aston Villa. They play at home to Sheffield United. Gregor, you've been writing a piece about the idea that they might be top at Christmas. Does it matter if they're top at Christmas?
No, I mean, we love symbolism, don't we, in the Premier League. And I think, actually, 10 of the last 14 seasons, the team who's finished top have won the Premier League. So it's a bit of a moment there. But it would just underline an extraordinary 2023 for Aston Villa. Extraordinary. Second best haul of points behind Man City in that calendar year. So when people talk about the sort of expectation that Villa are going to fall away at some point, for a full year they've been the second best team in the country, and they currently look better than the best one. So and all the things we've just spoken about the, you know, synergy between a manager and the club and the support structure around them, they're probably not a better example in the country either than, well, you could say Man City have been set up for Pep Guardiola for a long time, but Aston Villa are now set up to make Unai Emery every wish is satisfied, and the structure is in place to support him and to be a success. So every time I watch Villa now, the idea that they're going to fall away is eroded.
Interesting. Interesting. Johnny, do you agree with that? Because, I mean, Martin, you were talking a few weeks ago about this period for Villa, and I kind of asked, could we even now consider them title contenders? And you said, if they get through this Christmas period and they're still in the mix, then, of course, you have to.
February, I think. I said, if they're still around it by February, then you've got to consider
which
them.
Was the kind of Leicester City turning point, which you said for all you guys.
But it's also who will come in and replace them.
Yeah.
See, that's I think I made the point last week or the week before, and it still stands. If you're talking about them falling away, who is it that you think is going to come flying into that top four? Because Newcastle can't get it together consistently at the moment. Neither can Manchester United. Neither can Tottenham. All the teams outside of it aren't being consistent enough to push Aston Villa out. That was my point.
Absolutely. Johnny, to your point, do you think they're kind of in the mix this season?
I think they're title contenders. Yeah, I wrote that a couple of weeks ago. Why wouldn't they be? They've sustained this over a year now, more than a year. The 15 games unbeaten at home. And
15 consecutive wins.
Sorry, 15 consecutive wins. It's better than that, isn't it? And they've just got this... You know when you see it, when a coach has got like a club in the palm of his hand.
You know, well, he's another man you've interviewed, of course, this season, and it was a fascinating interview.
And you know, I would say nobody would come second place to Emery for intensity and ambition and but a charisma about him as well. And that's what really struck me when we sat down was you know, again, it's something you maybe have to feel in the room, but you just thought, wow, you know, you would be inspired by this guy. You'd be slightly fearful, but there's some slightly mad about him. But, but all of that, you knew he had that thing that makes people follow. And you know, at the weekend when the opposition go down to 10 men and they're 1-0 behind, you just knew what the result would be because they're so he's got them in such a mentally strong, ruthless place. And so it came to pass. And Ollie Watkins' reaction to the goal. I mean, look at the fire in Ollie Watkins, a guy that you've looked at for years.
He does look different, doesn't he? He's like a bit more swagger.
Yeah. He's just
cockiness almost.
He's got not cockiness, quite, yeah. But he's got that in the mall, hasn't he now?
Yeah.
And I think as well with Emery, that what happened at Arsenal, it's as if he's come back into English football and he thinks to himself, right, I'm not going to make that mistake again. I'm not going to have things just foisted upon me. The point you were making about Nottingham Forest, and I'm not saying how much power a manager has to resist that sometimes, but you know when it's so extreme as it clearly is at Forest. But that you know when he left Arsenal, he gave that press conference in which he said about all that I wanted this and I got that, and we wanted this and we got there. Yeah. And it's almost as if he's come back into English football. He's come to Villa and he's thought, right, that isn't happening again. This time, I'm going to ask for what I want. I'm going to get what I want. I'm going to insist on what I want. And they've given it to him. Mm-hmm. They've given it to him.
Mm, it's interesting talking about
smarter than Arsenal.
Getting what he wants and asking for it. Gregor, Chris, who's an Aston Villa fan, who's obviously very excited and a listener of the show, wanted me to ask you about Pau Torres, a signing in the summer. For a reported 31.5 million, a lot of money, but actually in the modern game, probably not that much money. 26, looks an incredibly classy player. He's a very good signing, isn't he, for them this season?
Yeah.
You're not as impressed?
No, I'm not. No.
Not as impressed as Chris?
Look, he offers a great balance because he's, you know, left-sided, as you say, and a big part of Villa's game is particularly when they have the ball in their own half or they're building from the back is being patient but then playing really sort of incisive passes through the centre of the pitch, and he's great at that. I think he's looked a little bit suspect at times defensively, but he's playing you know as part of a back line that a lot of the time as well is kind of doing,
makes you a bit jittery.
He's playing this brilliantly sort of well drilled high line, and there's been no issues with that. So but he has been a good signing. But I actually think out of all the, you know, I was looking for this piece, looking at the squad, and again, people are saying, oh, the squad's going to be thin. I don't see it. Mm. The only place I see a kind of step down in quality is in centre defence, where you're talking about Callum Chambers, Clement Longley, who was at Spurs and last year is on loan from Barcelona. Diego Carlos has kind of come back into the team here. I think he snapped his Achilles in his first game Steven Gerrard signed him. Ezra Konsa has been outstanding, but that's the only place. But because they have such a good structure, it could kind of make up for that. So Diaby's been the biggest signing, and you know, he's only signed 7 players since he arrived at Emery. This is really about making what he had before better. Mm. And of the 7 players, really, you can only say Diaby, Torres have had a real impact, and Tielemans is starting to, but the rest of them really have been about making the squad fit for competing in Europe on a Thursday and competing in the Premier League.
Yeah, well, you can read Gregor's piece on how Aston Villa have done this, got to the point of being title contenders, on the Times website. Now, chaps, we're going to finish with your Christmas wishes, what you want for the new year and what you want for 2024. Who should I start with? We've got some grimacing, we've got some head shaking. No one wants to go first. Martin, what are you asking the footballing gods for 2024?
Someone other than Manchester City to win the league.
Great.
Not because I've got anything against Manchester City, but I think 3 is enough. I rather like the fact that no one has ever won our league more than 3 years on the spin, and I'm sort of almost slightly worried when someone wins it four times, even though I think that the Man City domination thing ends with Pep Guardiola whenever Pep decides to stand down. They just become another elite football club and it will get considerably harder for them. Having said this, I would rather it sticks at three.
Any preference on who?
No, none at all. Aston Villa.
Yeah.
Right. If I had to name one,
yeah,
I'll name the one that is has won it least, basically, Aston Villa. And then, you know, basically, you can go through the rest of them in the order of how recently they won the league in terms of how much I would like. I just want to see. John Peel always said, when people said to John Peel about what do you want for music, what do you want? He just said, I just want to hear something I've never heard before. And that's how I feel about football. I want to see something I've never seen before. The greatest thing I ever saw was Leicester win the league. You know, because I never thought I'd see that. Never seen it before. Never thought I would see anything like that ever again, really, in football. And that remains the greatest thing I've ever seen in football. And so, yeah, I'd like to see Aston Villa win the league. But not Manchester City. And to any Manchester City fans that are listening, it's not because I don't like Manchester City. It is simply because I quite threes plenty.
Yeah. Johnny?
Yeah, well, I love that thought. I might be cutting Gregor's grass here a little bit because he might have similar...
There's a Scottish scowl going across the studio.
His eyes have narrowed.
It's an obvious one. It's, you know, I've been waiting my whole life and we all have for this, but it's just get out of the group stage at the Euros. I mean, that would just be that would just be amazing. And I think Scotland got a really good chance of doing it. I love the draw. It couldn't be better. You know, sort of fragile Germany up against the ruthlessness of Steve Clarke and Scott McTominay and John McGinn. You know, we've got a hungrier tough, but not unbeatable. Switzerland, good record against them. Quite fancy it.
Excellent, exciting. Gregor, you're going to have to come up with a new one.
I've got two.
Great, that's all right then.
John McGinn named Player of the Year.
For his bum.
Absolutely. And actually, I think for the Premier League not to be awarded a fifth Champions League spot.
I like it.
Because the idea of seven teams, there are now seven teams going at it for four places, feels more exciting to me than going at it for five.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating now how many teams are going to miss out on Champions League qualification who every year will start the season expecting it.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, I think the competition would be enhanced by not having the fifth spot.
Nice. Once you throw a random into it as well, like Aston Villa are this season, because if you think about it, that you know pushes it down. That makes it an eight almost, if you know what I mean, because Chelsea aren't even, you're not even thinking of Chelsea in contention
yeah, right,
at the moment.
I didn't even think of Chelsea.
You know, because Aston Villa. because Aston Villa have replaced Chelsea.
But Villa are one of the teams now
who
will expect it, because they have the backing, they have the manager of the right standing, you know, and, you know, that's what they see their future as.
Very good. Bringing it back to the topic at the top of the show. Well, I hope you all get what you want in 2024. All I want is more educated football debate with you lot. Martin, Johnny and Gregor, thank you very much for joining me. Remember, we've only got one more show this year, which will be out on Wednesday, the 27th. Until then, have a great Christmas, enjoying all the festive football on offer. Thanks for listening.